From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many evacuees in New Orleans were forced to leave their pets behind. The ASPCA is one of several groups that has sent volunteers in boats through flooded streets to rescue cats and dogs. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of those volunteers, Margaret McLaughlin. She's a vet tech at an ASPCA animal hospital. Also, the adventurer and film pioneer who made King Kong, helped team Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, and collaborated with John Ford on several now classic westerns. We talk with Mark Cotavaz about his biography of Marion C. Cooper. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many people who evacuated their homes in New Orleans were forced to leave behind their pets. For example, buses taking evacuees to Texas did not allow animals aboard, and those who snuck their pets through had to give them up in Houston before taking shelter at the Astrodome. Most shelters, hotels, and motels do not allow animals. The Humane Society estimates that 40,000 animals were left behind. The ASPCA is part of a coalition of humane organizations working together to rescue the animals who survived Katrina. So far, approximately 5,000 animals have been rescued. The ASPCA sent animal relief workers into the region on August 29th and started rescue missions on September 5th. My guest, Margaret McLaughlin, volunteered to go to the region on August 29th, working with the ASPCA. She started off doing triage work, then went off in animal rescue boats. She's the director of vet technicians at an ASPCA animal hospital in New York. She's also a certified search and rescue diver. She returned home on Saturday. I spoke with her and asked what the strategy was in dispatching rescuers to specific locations.
Lamar Dixon was the staging area where we were all staying. Every night there would be a meeting of all the heads of the different organizations, and they would be passed out a list of addresses that the owners had called the 800 number for the LASPCA. So we would take this list and go out every morning and work off a grid system.
So tell me one of the stories about going to an address to find pets. Tell me a story about what it was like.
Well, one of the most memorable stories was, which a lot of people know this story already, it's the story of Rudy the pig. His owners called the 800 number and asked to have Rudy removed from the house. They learned that it was the last day that they could surrender and evacuate peacefully, or they would be physically removed from their home by the police. So out of desperation, they called the LASPCA number and asked to have Rudy removed. So when we motored up to the house was completely, there was like a moat completely around the house of water, this filthy water. And when we went into the house, they were very happy to see us. And so was Rudy, who was about 300 pounds. Rudy lived in the house. He had his own little bedroom with little pig pictures and all kinds of pig stuff. Yeah, it was really amazing. He had his own little bed, and the sheet on the bed had little pigs on it. So these were people that really, really, really loved their pet pig.
So what did you do with the 300-pound animal? Did you fit on your
boat? Yeah, we had a huge dog carrier that we had the top off of. We brought that into the house. We had the pig stand on a blanket, and between six people, we lifted up the pig and placed him into the carrier and then put the top on the carrier. And the most wonderful feeling was when I told the owner that, because he was like, oh, I can't stay here anymore because I know that I'll never see my pig again. And I said, that's not true. And he said, aren't you going to euthanize the pig? And I said, no, we're taking your pig and we're going to keep him safe until you have your stuff together and you can come and pick him up again. And when he heard that we weren't going to euthanize his pet pig, he was just so happy and he was hugging us all. It was really, really wonderful.
What are you going to do with it? Where are you going to keep the pig?
The pig now is at Gonzales. Lamar Dixon is an equestrian center where that's the main staging area for the New Orleans area. It has several barns with probably 50 to 60 horse stalls in each of the barns. So that's where all of the animals are being held. Mm-hmm. So Rudy right now lives with another pig and a goat, last I saw him.
Well, you know, although most of your search was very directed because you had addresses from pet owners, did you see a lot of, like animals who had, like, left their home and were wandering around, you know, lost and afraid?
Oh, yes. We saw a lot of them. In this one neighborhood that we went to, the St. Bernard Parish area, we would just motor down the street and just whistle. And at any given time, you could hear 5 or 6 different dogs barking. And we would just, you know, capture them and collect them and put them in carriers. And when our boat was full, we'd just bring them back to our staging area, go back out again, get another boat full. One of the addresses that we heard dogs barking from, we actually saved 5 beagles. They had crawled up a tree that was knocked down by the hurricane, and they were in the way top branches, probably only 10 feet off the ground because the tree was laying down. And they were very, very scared, and they ran away and ran into their little, there were like little boxes for them. I guess it was like a puppy mill type of place. Some of the beagles were dead, but there were 5 that were alive, and we rescued them.
When you were rescuing dogs that were lost or afraid, were they afraid of you, or did they see you as a potential rescuer? I mean, I think a lot of animals, when they're afraid, they either hide or they fight.
Oh, yeah. That was a problem. The majority of the dogs would be, and the cats, were very, very frightened. You have to think it. Most of the time they were hiding under beds, or they were outside and hiding under whatever they could hide under. And we would use ropes and cash poles and stuff to try to get them out from under whatever they were hiding. And we had to take care not to get ourselves bit or injured.
How did you do that? What precautions did you take?
Well, to get cats, most of the time we would have an actual carrier, cat carrier. And the majority of the time when you're capturing a cat, they'll go into a box. So the cats were pretty much easy. You could just kind of scoot them in or scare them into a corner and kind of trap them, and then they would go in. But the dogs are another story. They will not willingly go into a box. And then you would have to throw a leash on them or entice them with food.
Did you carry a lot of food for that purpose?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And you also have to be careful not to feed them too much because they hadn't eaten in quite a few days, and you need to just give them very, very small meals at first. So when enticing them, you know, we had to just give them tiny little pieces, just enough to get them over to you where you could slip a leash around their necks.
When the dogs were afraid of you, not realizing that you were there to save them, did that hurt at all? I mean, here you are, making many sacrifices to save these pets, and of course they don't know that, and they're not necessarily going to be like appreciative of your presence or friendly to you.
Yes, it that's a little hard when you're wrestling and jumping over things. I mean, sometimes we'd have to like jump on top of, you know, when you got out of the boat, you would have to jump on top of a car, from car to car to a porch or something like that, to try to wrestle this, you know, biting, vicious pit bull. You'd be like, what am I doing here? But as soon as you got the leash on them and you gave them a little food, the majority of them, they were appreciative. They were just scared and protecting, you know, their last stand.
Would you do certain things to try to calm them down, speak to them in a certain way?
Oh, yeah. Speak to them really softly. Give them little names. The food. Just very calmly move your hands. Approach them. Lower yourself so that you're not towering over them.
What was one of the riskier things that you did to rescue a dog?
I climbed over 2 cars. Well, one of them was a van, onto the roof of another car.
I mean, these are cars that were mostly submerged?
Yes. So just their roofs were showing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I walked up the back steps of a house where they were metal steps that were kind of not very secured to the building, to the second floor, which it had an open roof. And the water at one point had been probably a foot higher than it was because there were three dogs trapped on that roof. So I walked up those steps, and I was able to entice two of them with food. They at first were barking and growling and lunging at me. But once they realized that I was a friend and I was trying to feed them and help them, they calmed down, and I got them into the carriers. And one of them actually jumped off the roof into the water and started to swim around where one of the people working with me on my team, he jumped in the water and started after the dog, and he got a leash on the dog, and the dog eventually paddled over to our boat where we pulled him up into the boat.
I'm wincing as I hear this because I'm thinking about what's in the water, and I'm thinking of the dog jumping in it and of your colleague jumping in it.
Yeah, well, we had dry suits on. We were completely equipped with dry suits. So the only thing, we never got our heads exposed to the water, but our hands were exposed. Our hands and our feet were exposed.
Do you have any sores on them?
No, no.
Did you see, like, sores or infections on animals as a result of having been in the water?
Surprisingly, the animals that I saw one dog that he obviously had been standing in the water for quite a while, and he had sores on his feet. But horses, I saw quite a few horses at the Lamar Dixon staging area that had been standing in water, and they were pretty bad off with the fungal infections.
Did you see any horses while you were, boating around the city looking for pets?
No, no. Cats, dogs.
What about rats and alligators?
No alligators. We did see one water moccasin.
Mm-hmm.
We saw two goldfish swimming. Barely swimming on the surface.
Any rats?
One rat. A lot of dead cats and puppies.
Floating?
Yeah.
Not dogs, just puppies?
Yeah, I didn't see any dead dogs. I mean, in the water. There were dead dogs in homes, but not in the water.
Do the dead dogs that you find in homes die of starvation or of drowning?
Drowning.
Were you able to see signs of some of the things that pet owners had done in the hopes that it would help their pets survive the storm?
Oh, yeah. Most of the cats that we rescued were doing really, really well and had probably had no idea what was going on outside. Most of the owners had left plenty of food, plenty of water, many different cat boxes, even for single cat homes. We often saw three and four cat boxes and an abundance of food. That was probably all the people that did that, all their animals were really well off. You know, they were just scared and lonely.
My guest is Margaret McLaughlin. We'll talk more about her experiences rescuing pets in New Orleans with the ASPCA after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Margaret McLaughlin. She spends several days volunteering with the ASPCA in New Orleans, going out on boats to search for and rescue stranded pets. A lot of the animals that you rescued, you knew their identity because their owners had already told you the address and had asked you to rescue their pets. But there were a lot of dogs that you rescued that you didn't know who they were, how do you identify where they're from, who their owners are, and try to get in touch?
Well, what we would do, some of the animals had collars with tags, so that was pretty easy. But if an animal was found in a backyard of an address, when we would make a paper collar for them, and we would write, found in backyard of 2798, whatever. Those are the animals that are going to be very difficult for the people to find again.
If they're not claimed, what's going to happen to them? You know, people always worry with the ASPCA that if an animal isn't claimed in a certain amount of time, that the animal will be put to death. Now that there are so many animals that have been rescued from the ASPCA, what's going to happen to those who aren't matched up with their owners?
Well, Houston SPCA has done a tremendous amount of work fostering pets and setting up all kinds of databases. Pet Finder and Chameleon are setting up databases, pictures. Eventually, I think what will happen is these pets will probably, those that are not matched up with their owners, will probably be scattered throughout the country in different types of databases. And they will be found homes. I'm quite certain of that, that every one of the pets will be found a home. A lot of people like to adopt animals that come from something like Katrina. Oh, my dog was a rescue from Katrina. People like to have something attached to their animals.
Did you decide to adopt any yourself?
Oh, there was a cute little puppy that I really wanted, but my husband was like, "You can't bring home any more animals."
Did you find animals who were traveling in packs?
I think there was some talk of animals roaming in packs, but most of the dogs that we saw that were in a group, they were always in a group, like they were in somebody's backyard or on someone's porch. They seemed to be of the same family.
Animals don't often like each other's company very much. You know, dogs bark at each other and get into fights on the street. Cats are not pleased when strange animals are in their presence. So what was it like to bring all these animals together who were already spooked onto a boat?
Well, they were in their separate individual carriers. So most of them were kind of scared being on the boat to begin with, so they didn't really say anything. The cats pretty much just, you know, hid in the back of the cages, and the dogs were kind of scared being on the water. So most of the time they were very quiet. Occasionally we would put two animals together that we thought were a family, like a mother and her puppies, or two older dogs that we thought were a family. And then occasionally you'd hear some barking or a little bit of fighting going on. But other than that, most of the time the animals were very quiet inside the boat.
How many trips in and out did you make during a day?
2 to 3.
How many animals at one time could you carry?
Depending, like the day that we got the beagles, all 5 beagles were in one carrier. So we could probably have 10 animals on a boat, 6 to 10 animals.
And did you travel in a little fleet of rescue boats?
Yes, at any given time there were 5 to 6 boats, 3 people per team, so that there was always one person with the boat and 2 people could go out of the boat and find the animal.
Did you have any close calls during your rescue operation?
Yeah, I was entering a house via the back porch. And when I got up to the very top step of the porch, the back steps, as I went to step off the steps into the house, the steps totally gave away and started floating. And I was like floating and balancing and teeter-tottering. And I made a big giant stride and jumped into the house. It was like a cartoon.
And what did you find in the house?
We rescued two cats out of that house.
How'd you get back out if the stairs had floated away?
Jumped down, and then it was about chest high, the water.
So you jumped down into the water?
Yeah. We were in our dry suits.
But your face wasn't covered?
No, but the water was about chest high.
I see.
Yeah. Often we were walking in the water. And just imagine, you know, walking into a backyard, what you're walking over. You're walking over, you know, fallen trees and shrubs and plants and barbecues and picnic tables and you name it can be back there.
Which you can't even see because it's in the water.
Exactly. So you have to very gingerly kind of shuffle your feet and step, you know, all the time holding your balance.
Margaret McLaughlin will talk more about her animal rescue work with the ASPCA in New Orleans in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. And from The Wall Street Journal, introducing the new Saturday Weekend Edition, designed to inspire when it's time to unwind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Margaret McLaughlin about rescuing stranded pets in New Orleans. Also, the story of Marion C. Cooper, the filmmaker and adventurer who made King Kong, collaborated with John Ford on Now Classic Westerns, and helped team Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Margaret McLaughlin. She's the director of vet technicians at an ASPCA animal hospital in New York. McLaughlin volunteered to work with the ASPCA animal rescue team in New Orleans. She worked on boats that went through the New Orleans neighborhoods searching for and rescuing stranded pets. Did you see a lot of National Guard or police?
Oh, they were everywhere. We normally entered the city at about 9 a.m., and we had to be out. It was a 5:30 curfew. We had to be out of the city or on our way out of the city by 5:30. And at any given time, there were truckloads of military people, whether they be in those amphibians or a Black Hawk helicopter flying overhead or just sheriffs walking by.
Did you have any special, badges or markings on your clothes to indicate to police or to the National Guard that you were from the ASPCA and you had an official function?
For the first few days, I wore my ASPCA badge, but it's just a badge and it's small, my picture ID. But we were dressed in dry suits, which are very colorful. Some of them were blue and yellow. Some were yellow and black. We had life vests on. We had helmets on. And we had a boatload of carriers, animal carriers. So nobody ever questioned us. They knew, oh, you're here for the animals. Or they would just approach us and tell us about some other animals that they saw someplace else. They knew, everybody knew who we were.
Did you run into a lot of other rescue teams in the water?
Not animal rescues, because we were on grids, but we did run into a few human rescues that we would see them going by. Actually, my team rescued one group of humans. The man had a stroke 4 days earlier. Now, we were supposed to only rescue animals, but a Black Hawk helicopter swooped very above us, and it was low enough that he was making the water rippling, and he was making all kinds of signals to us, and all of us being civilians had no idea what they wanted us to do. Finally, we understood that they wanted us to go a block away from where we were, but there was no outlet. So we actually had this Black Hawk helicopter take us in a kind of in a roundabout way and direct us to a house that had four people in the house. And the father, he was very old, probably in his 80s. He had a stroke 4 days earlier. So they told us that we needed to rescue these people and take them.
And were you able to do it?
Yeah. We lifted up the elderly man and we put him in the boat and I think it was two sons and his daughter and a couple of pieces of their luggage. We put them in the boat and we walked alongside the boat back to our staging area.
Did you find any dead people in your search for pets?
I did see a few bodies outside on the streets, not in the houses.
And what would you do when you saw dead bodies? Were you supposed to report them?
No. We just continued on our way. It was kind of par for the course. It wasn't, we were told that we would see them. The military was all over the place. I mean, a massive military presence everywhere. And they were aware of it. We weren't on any streets that they weren't on.
Were you surprised at all by what your actual reaction was to seeing dead bodies floating by?
Yeah, at first it was kind of one of those things where you can't stop staring, but you can't turn your head away. And then the next time I was walking, pulling the boat. It was a very shallow area. And I was walking on the street, and there was a body on my right and a turned over porta potty on the left. And I was thinking to myself, well, at least now I know what this smell is that I'm smelling. And it's kind of indescribable. You really have to be there to understand how you think.
Some people listening now might be thinking, is it appropriate to worry so much about pets and have a rescue operation for pets when not all of the people were rescued and when there were still dead human bodies floating by, is that the kind of thing that you thought about much? You know, is it appropriate to worry about animals when there are still people in jeopardy?
It's all kind of connected. Most of the people that we saw that would not evacuate, they would not evacuate because they still had their pets, and they would not leave their pets behind. So it's kind of, we go in and get their pets, and then they can be evacuated. So it's pretty much the same, even though we're helping the animals, and our mission is to help the animals, we're still helping the people.
You know, people who survive a catastrophe can get counseling, but you can't really counsel animals and help them understand what's happened to them and help them return to a more stable existence or explain to them that they can never go home again. Have you spoken to other people who are doing pet rescue about dealing with the animal's trauma after they're rescued?
Yeah, thank goodness that there are so many people that are kind-hearted enough to volunteer their shelter help. All of these animals, they need special attention. They need walks. They need quality walks. They need quality time with people that are going to be there just to sit with them or pet them, encourage them, because we can't speak to them.
How did you feel about risking your health to save other people's pets?
At first, I was a little nervous about touching the water, but just the more I saw the pets coming out of the water and the houses, and they were covered with muck, the more I was like, you know, I didn't think about it. I just wanted to help, and I wanted to do whatever I could for the animals and for the people whose pets they were, that I would hope that somebody would go into my house if necessary someday.
At the risk of sounding kind of corny in times of a crisis, but what's like the cutest image that stays in your mind?
The cutest image is this adorable little black pit bull puppy. She was so hard to capture because she was so cute. We couldn't get a leash around her. She was just a squiggly, wiggly thing that just, you know, like, you see some dogs, you go to pet them and immediately they're on their backs and giving you their stomach.
Right, yeah.
Well, that's what she was doing. And every time we tried to get the lead around her neck, she was just wiggly and licking you. And, you know, you don't want this dog to lick you because it's been in this mucky water. So you're trying to keep your distance. But at the same time, this dog is just like so thrilled that you're there. And she was very cute.
Is this a dog you thought about adopting yourself?
Yeah, I would have taken her in a second.
But you didn't because your husband didn't want more animals.
Right. And most of these animals have homes. It's just a matter
of
getting
right.
getting the owners, matching the owners with the pets.
So how do you feel now?
I'm very tired. I'm mentally and physically exhausted. I arrived back in the city on Saturday night, and I pretty much slept all of Sunday and all of Monday. And today's my first day back at work, but I'm very tired. That's what I could say. But I'm very, very happy to be home.
Well, Margaret, thank you for the work that you did, and thank you for talking with us about it.
Thank you.
Margaret McLaughlin worked as a volunteer with the ASPCA Animal Rescue Mission in New Orleans. She's the director of Vet Techs at an ASPCA hospital in New York. Coming up, the filmmaker and adventurer who created King Kong. This is Fresh Air. King Kong will return to the screen in December in a remake directed by Peter Jackson, who made the Lord of the Rings movies. We're going to hear about the man who made the original King Kong.
Come on, I got him! He'll be out for hours. Send to the ship for anchor chains and tools.
What are you going to do?
To build a raft to float him to the ship. Why, the whole world will pay to see this.
No chains will ever hold that.
We'll give him more than chains. He's always been king of his world, but we'll teach him fear. We're millionaires, boys. I'll share it with all of you. Why, in a few months, it'll be up in lights on Broadway. Kong, the eighth wonder of the world!
The character of Carl Denham, the adventurer, filmmaker, and promoter who brings King Kong to New York, bears some resemblance to the adventurer and filmmaker who created the film. C. Marion Cooper was an adventurer and documentary filmmaker who traveled through Africa and made documentaries in Persia, which is now Iran, and Siam, which is now Thailand. That work led him to the more mythical idea of King Kong. Denham is a fascinating behind-the-scenes Hollywood figure. He was also the production head of RKO, helped team Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, produced several now classic John Ford westerns, including The Searchers and She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and was instrumental in the development of Cinerama. Cooper's story is told in a new biography called Living Dangerously. I spoke with the author, Mark Cotta Vaz. Would you describe the original idea for King Kong that Cooper had?
Well, the original idea for King Kong sort of evolved. The original idea was, it was almost like if you could imagine two movie explorers getting to, or movie expedition guys sitting around and telling the ultimate tall tale. That's kind of how King Kong began. Cooper was in New York in the late 1920s and early 30s pursuing interests in commercial aviation. So that was his, he had sort of left Hollywood, but he seemed entranced with telling this story about this gorilla, and he had this friend of his, W. Douglas Burden. And Burden had made this great expedition to the Komodo Island, where the famous dragons of Komodo, so-called, exist, these huge primordial-looking creatures. And Cooper always had this fantasy that of doing a movie where he would film a live gorilla seemingly in conflict with a live Komodo dragon. But so they wanted to do this dramatic, you know, lost world idea of a lost island and these creatures battling each other. But as the idea evolved, it became much more romantic, and he started realizing, I'm not going to be able to do this with live animals.
So he decided against using like the real animals and ended up going with stop motion animation. He knew he didn't want a guy in an ape suit. Why was he so sure that that would be the wrong thing?
Well, because a guy in an ape suit looks phony. You can tell it's a guy in an ape suit, and that's the way it was done. And Cooper was always this bombastic showman, bigger and better. He wanted to bring the world through his moving pictures spectacle. And he wanted to say, how can I make this dream, this what he would call of his giant terror gorilla, how can I make something so romantic, so fantastic, so nightmarish come true? And it turned out that stop-motion animation was the best way to do that.
Now, the Empire State Building nearly didn't make it into King Kong. Why not?
Yeah, the thing about King Kong is that it was... Now, Cooper claimed he never saw the movie The Lost World, but for those that remember the Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story and the movies that were made that were inspired by that book... there is this whole scenario of a beast from a lost world being brought to civilization. In the case of the Lost World movie, it's London. So there was actually this threat of a legal action, you know, because the idea is if you bring King Kong to New York, well, that's very similar to the whole scenario of the Lost World, prehistoric beast coming to civilization. So at one point, they weren't going to use the scene. And, you know, Cooper actually said, well, maybe we could go ahead and drop. We won't have a good picture, but we'll have a good enough picture. He just felt that, well, maybe we're just going to have to lose the whole New York sequence. And the whole movie of King Kong would have been set on Skull Island. But what happened is they ended up essentially buying the rights to The Lost World, you know, the copyright right to it. So by owning it, they essentially, and they also got the waiver, so they didn't have to credit The Lost World. Cooper always claimed the Lost World had nothing to do with King Kong, but for whatever reason, the legal guys basically squared it all away, because if they hadn't, King Kong would have ended on Skull Island, where it began.
Now, you know, there's so much like bondage imagery in King Kong. Like, for example, in the first half of the movie, you know, Fay Wray is tied up with one arm attached, you know, with each arm attached to a separate pole, and she's just like wriggling around trying to get free from those poles, wearing, you know, fairly skimpy clothing, while King Kong comes and you know, admires her and growls and so on, and you know, that's just the beginning. And I wonder if you think that Cooper knew what he was doing, if he was consciously saying, well, let's put in a little bit of bondage imagery in this, that, you know, that'll work with the audience.
Well, Cooper always claimed there was no decadent, quote-unquote, rape connotation to any of this. Actually, I came across this interesting letter that the film historian and critic Richard Schickel had written to Cooper's widow, Dorothy Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, Dorothy Jordan was objecting to exactly the kind of question that you posed. And Richard Schickel was basically sent a very nice reply to her, basically saying, I'm doing it the honor of respecting it and by asking these questions, because Schickel felt that one of the reasons why a work of popular art endures is because it has a lot of unanswered questions and people can read things into it. Cooper always claimed that, you know, there was none of this bondage thing. I mean, there's the whole business where Kong starts taking her clothes off,
mm-hmm.
and smelling his fingers, and mm-hmm. those were actually cut in the ensuing theatrical re-releases. There was a number of bits of business in King Kong that were deemed, you know, too provocative or whatever, and that was one of them. So, you know, it's something that people will debate. I mean, there was this one book that came out that talked about the whole rape thing, you know, and Kong's penis. And I just always had this amazing, you know, Marion Cooper and Dorothy Jordan were they were a great couple, and they were worldly people, but they were pretty conservative. And, you know, he was a good Southern gentleman. And just the idea of people talking like that, I always had this image of Cooper just cringing, you know, because I honestly don't think that was his intent. I think it was more the idea of beauty being totally vulnerable. It's maybe less a bondage thing as it was just exposing her. He wanted to do a sacrificial ritual thing, and that's, you know, she's put out there to be sacrificed.
Cooper was such a showman. Was he involved in the actual advertising of King Kong once the movie was ready to open?
Cooper was the RKO department had a whole advertising, you know, department to dedicate. In fact, it's very funny. There are all these like in-house memos at the time where they were talking about this is going to be the greatest, you know, movie ever. And anyone that doesn't fail to live up to the expectations of the movie can consider themselves a failure. I mean, it was very much like the Carl Denham character in the movie saying they're going to have to think of a lot of new adjectives when I get back. I mean, it was this bombastic spectacle. And Cooper at that time, actually, what had happened was Cooper Selznick left RKO as head of production, and Cooper took his place because the King Kong production had been such a risk, and it was coming through. Clearly, the studio knew they had a hit on their hands. And so, essentially, the board of directors at RKO allowed Cooper to ascend to the height of Hollywood power and influence. I mean, he became head of the whole studio, of the production side. And so I think he was very involved in just pushing all the buttons to make sure that things were working. But at that point, he was also starting to transition to become production head in charge of all the movies the studio was going to release. And one of his decisions was, let's do a sequel to King Kong. And he rushed that into production. I mean, the sequel, Son of Kong, came out the very same year, 1933, as Kong did.
I didn't realize it was so quick.
it was almost like blinding. It's like, whoa. I mean, and that was a little bit more Cooper, more the mogul. You know, supposedly he told Shodzak. Shodzak would direct it. He basically said, here's a couple $100,000. Go out and make this movie. Anything with Kong in the title will be a hit. And, you know, so it's a little bit more of the moguls speaking, not from the heart. I mean, Kong is from the heart, from him.
My guest is Mark Cotta-Vaz, the author of Living Dangerously, The Adventures of Marion C. Cooper. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Cotta-Vaz, and his new book, Living Dangerously, is a biography of Marion C. Cooper, who created King Kong. Cooper fought in World War I. He fought again in World War II and then became a staunch anti-communist. He supported Joe McCarthy. How did that affect the movies he made after the war?
Yeah, the whole... He was a virulent anti-communist, and he really had this... going back to being in these Moscow prison camps, he had been shot down when he was helping the Poles fight the invading Bolsheviks, and he had been captured, and he endured, like, the hell of the prison camps, and he had this great escape. And so he always claimed that he knew firsthand and experienced the early communist brainwashing capability and psychological warfare, and he always took the communists at their word that they were bent on world domination. And Cooper felt to counter that, he had to do a new type of American propaganda. So he had formed a company before the war that was reactivated after the war with John Ford, the great director, called Argosy Pictures. And all the John Wayne movies they did, the cavalry pictures that Cooper doesn't get credit. You know, John Ford directed them, but Cooper produced those. It's like the cavalry trilogy.
So that's the Ford Apache, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon.
All those movies were meant to sort of like lift up the idea of the American military corps and to be an inspirational message. But his crowning thing was Cinerama. He got involved with Lowell Thomas in doing that great, you know, movie This Is Cinerama, and pioneering this whole new medium of the big screen, which ended up opening up all the big screens in America and in the world. We forget that the old movie screens used to be more like little box-shaped. The screens went wide after Cinerama, you know. But there's this great America the Beautiful scene in Cinerama where there's a plane with a Cinerama camera that flew across the country taking pictures of this great land. And, you know, it's done to the music of the Star-Spangled Banner, America the Beautiful, rather. And Cooper just meant that as his love poem to America, and he just wanted to extol the virtues of this country.
Now, one thing we didn't mention, you know, as part of Cooper's storied career, one of the things he did was help put Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers together on screen. What was his role in that now famous match?
Cooper basically paired them. Originally, Fred Astaire was going to be in this movie Flying to Rio with Dorothy Jordan, the woman he ended up marrying. Well, he always made this comment that, well, once I married her, essentially he wasn't going to let her dance with Fred Astaire. I mean, for this debonair, you know, dashing guy. Essentially when he married Dorothy Jordan, her movie career kind of ended until the 50s. Film buffs will probably recognize her as the woman that opens up The Searchers. She's the frontier wife that's waiting for John Wayne. But essentially, she was going to be paired with Fred Astaire. And so when they got married, Cooper said, okay, well, I'm going to get someone else to dance with Fred. And then there's this woman, Ginger Rogers, and he paired them. He did a lot of stuff like that. He He basically sent the memo to Selznick asking for a screen test for a certain Broadway actress named Katharine Hepburn. He had a great eye for talent, and at RKO, particularly when he became production head, he really wanted the studio to be focused on women stars. He really felt that female stars were going to be very important in the studio, and that's so I think he had an eye for people like Ginger Rogers, and let's put them in this romantic setting with this dashing dancer, and that was one of his thinking, which is almost incongruous when you think about it, this two-fisted adventurer war hero making movies designed to appeal to, you know, women. But he was a multifaceted guy.
Mark Cottavaz is the author of Living Dangerously, The Adventures of Marion C. Cooper. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me. The way your smile just beams, the way you sing off key, the way you haunt my dreams. No, no, they can't take that away from me. We may never, never meet again on the bumpy road to love. Still, I'll always, always keep the memory of.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of the works of Tom Robbins, including his new hardcover, Wild Ducks Flying Backward, The Short Writings of Tom Robbins. And from Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Chris Mooney talks about his new book, The Republican War on Science. And we talk with Robert Walker. During the 2000 presidential campaign, he served as the Bush advisor on science, space, and technology. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.